For the week of March 11th, 2018, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 403, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Allentown, Pennsylvania, I'm Michael Giltz. Sperling, how much money do you have?
You mean in my pockets? Oh, okay. Well, let's see. I've got $15.82. Why do you ask?
So, Sperling, remember when I said we should have bought the Weinstein Company? It was for sale. Okay, so we're still a little short, but the sale was on, and then it was off, and then it was on, and then it was off, and then it was on. All I know is that it has collapsed again.
Okay, so does that mean I should...
When we predicted 2 weeks ago, we're like, this isn't going to happen. And then it came on again. I thought, well, I was wrong. Turns out, no, we were right. It has, in fact, collapsed again. They turned up a little few extra, you know, dotting the I's, crossing the T's. Turns out the Weinstein Company had an extra $64 million in liability that hadn't come up before. Oops. And that apparently has queered the deal again. So the Ron Burkle Investor Group has stepped away again, and the company may have to be sold for parts.
Pretty much, yeah. Although, you know, I'm thinking, Michael, maybe you and I can get together. We could start an Indiegogo or Kickstarter campaign.
That's a good idea. All I know is that people are losing their job. There's one less player in the business. That's all too bad. I wasn't clear to me how the Weinstein name would be useful or helpful to anyone down the road. But we were right. So there you go. Maybe we'll be right again this week. So people who want to be smart should listen to our show. And if they do, what will they hear about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we are still recovering from the Academy Awards. But Michael has one more thing to say about preferential balloting. Now, can we take a vote on that story, actually? No?
No.
No? Okay. Well, we've also got an update on MoviePass. Guess what? They know where you are all the time. In TV, we discussed the remarkable story in the Wall Street Journal about the Fox Network's plan to reduce primetime ads by a lot. During Book Filter, Michael will offer not one, not even two, but three books primed for pickup. In our sexual misconduct segment, we will discuss how author Sherman Alexie is paying a price for past misconduct. During Inside Baseball, the Justice Department weighs in with new arguments about the proposed AT&T merger with Time Warner. Apparently, it's going to be bad for consumers, bad for competitors, bad for the country, and even bad for grandma and apple pie, as far as we can tell from what the good old US of A is arguing. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull information from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, The New York Times, The LA Times. You, our listeners, the number one movie around the world, again, is Black Panther. Thank you, China. The movie opened up in China amid questions as to whether the Chinese people would go see a film that's dominated by black people. And the answer is yes. $66 million it made in China alone over the weekend. It made $141 million this weekend. It passed the $1 billion mark. It's at $1,078 million. Still, obviously, has a little ways to go. It's the 33rd film in history to gross $1 billion.
Now, get this. In its fourth weekend in the market, okay? Now, I know China opened, but its fourth weekend in the market, it grossed $141 million. That's like a great opening worldwide weekend. Okay, like if you can open to $141 million worldwide, you're doing really good. Now, you're in your fourth weekend, you've opened in most territories, and you have one additional territory. Granted, it's the second largest box office market in the world, but you've grossed $141 million. That's pretty darn good. That means you had $80 million outside of China. So
it would have been the number one movie worldwide, even without China.
Correct, yeah. Remarkable.
It, in fact, would have doubled the number two movie, which is A Wrinkle in Time, the Ava DuVernay film based on the classic children's book by Madeleine L'Engle. I don't know how to say her name. It grossed $40 million worldwide, seven territories, mostly in North America, where it came in second to Black Panther, which was presented as a big battle royale. But the point is, what matters is not, you know, one movie versus another, but one movie versus its own budget. A Wrinkle in Time cost $100 million to make. It opened to $40 million. It's certainly a bit of a disappointment given the poor reviews and what looks like a softer opening. Maybe it will have great legs. Maybe teenage girls will keep turning out to see it again and again. It has a strong female component to it. We'll have to see how it plays out around the world, but not a great start for A Wrinkle in Time. But on the other hand, they have a great Sade song, and I love Sade, so I'm happy the movie exists.
Well, now, of course, this was like Disney v. Disney, right? Because, you know, A Wrinkle in Time is a Disney film, and you have Marvel, you know, coming in number one at the box office with Black Panther, and, you know...
But I don't think they're hurting each other. I think it's just it could have succeeded even bigger. It just was a film that didn't work for critics and hasn't gotten tremendous audience response, but we'll have to see. Maybe it'll have good legs.
Right, but I just want to point out, okay, mm-hmm. is that if you look at Black Panther, you mentioned that it's the, what, 33rd film to gross $1 billion, right? Of those 33 films, nearly half, like 48%, are Disney films. 16 of those titles are Disney films.
Well, and most of them come from within the last 10 or 15 years as well. We've talked before, 33 films. If you look at the highest grossing movies of all time, in a minute, you're going to have 50 movies. To be in the top 50, you're going to have to gross $1 billion. That's going to happen within the next 5 years. I think we'll get another 17 films in the next 5 years that gross $1 billion. In the blink of an eye, you're going to have a top 100 films of all time worldwide. And that's going to be a $1 billion club. It's just the way the world is going. There's a lot more money being made all over around the world. Not so much for Red Sparrow, the Jennifer Lawrence drama or thriller, I should say, grossed $23 million on this weekend. It's at $82 million worldwide. But Operation Red Sea is doing great. That's the Chinese flag-waving Rambo-like movie. $23 million on the weekend, $530 million worldwide. At number five is Tomb Raider, the reboot starring Alicia Vikander. $14 million when it opened up in about 9 territories. So an okay overseas start. We'll have to see how it does. I can't find information on the budget. I've looked everywhere, but nobody seems to know what the budget is. The original, starring Angelina Jolie, cost about $100 million, maybe $115 million. I'm assuming this isn't a cheapo movie, so I assume it's probably at least $100 million, but who knows? At number six is The Shape of Water, the Oscar winner for Best Picture. Another $13 million on the weekend. It did get a boost up in territories where it's still playing. That's at $150 million worldwide.
And China is next week.
And number seven is Game Night, the adult comedy. $13 million on the weekend, $70 million worldwide. And then there's at number eight, the Peter Rabbit, the family film, another $11 million for that movie. That's at $120 million worldwide. So that is going to triple its budget of $50 million. And number nine is Detective Chinatown 2, another $11 million for that movie. That's at $525 million worldwide. So Operation Red Sea is passing that by. They're not so far apart in grosses. I mean, Red Sea grossed $23 million. This grossed $11 million. They're both at about $530 million. Clearly, Operation Red Sea is going to make more. I think that's probably slowing down a bit too, though. So they're both probably going to be under $600 million. So that's just a terrific result for both those films. Operation Red Sea will be the big winner. Detective Chinatown 2 has done great. There will be a Detective Chinatown 3. I'm sure there will be an Operation blah, 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 sending some other area where the Chinese military can rescue Chinese citizens.
I think it needs to be L.A. or San Francisco or, you know, where somebody could say, forget it, Jake, it's Chinatown.
Good idea. I'm sure we won't have to wait a decade for that sequel, though. I'm sure that will come out next year or the year after, which makes our next movie a little confusing. It's Strangers Pray at Night. It's a horror flick. It grossed $10 million on the weekend. It cost about $5 million to make, so it's doing great. It's a sequel to The Stranger. That film was about a couple being terrorized. Oh, where were they? In an empty mansion or something? This time, a couple is terrorized in an empty trailer park, a mobile home trailer park. A horror flick, low budget, spawned a sequel. Why did it take a decade?
You were asking me? I have no idea.
Yeah. I have no idea. The first one came out in 2008, and it was very, very profitable. It made about $90 million. And this spinoff, they've decided they've got a franchise. It took a decade to come out. I couldn't figure out why.
Maybe rights disputes, or who knows?
I don't know. At number 11 is Death Wish. Now we've dropped out of the $10 million mark. So in the top 10 worldwide, all the movies made $10 million or more. Death Wish made $9 million in the weekend. That's at $30 million from 21 territories. So not great work so far from a kind of an ugly, low-budget, nasty film starring Bruce Willis. I hate the Death Wish franchise. It's so nihilistic and nasty. I'm just surprised they would bother remaking it. And if they did, why they didn't put some spin on it that would sort of, you know, give a new twist or make it less sort of reprehensible. I don't know. At number 12 is the French comedy Une la petite famille, the broad comedy about a hotshot architect who's ashamed of his family. The twist I didn't catch when I rewatched a trailer was that he gets hit by a...
Yeah,
he gets in, he decides he loves this. Suddenly his hotshot young wife, he's this, you know, important, you know, sophisticated guy. Suddenly he's back with his family and living it up and loving life and, you know, very basic again or something like that.
Yeah.
So that made $8 million in the weekend. That's at $32 million worldwide.
This had a really good trailer, actually.
Oh, yeah? You liked it?
Yeah.
Did you see the trailer for Amazing China? That's a documentary film that's in China right now. It made $8 million on the weekend. It's at $35 million, all playing in China, in the Middle Kingdom. And one notable thing about the film is that the government was not allowing customers to review it online. You weren't reviewing this movie. You weren't saying, I didn't like Amazing China. You were going to like Amazing China. And if you didn't like it, they didn't hear from you. You just didn't see any customer comments or any customer reviews of this movie. It's agitprop. It's propaganda for the country. They wanted everybody to love it. For a documentary film, it's doing great, assuming the grosses are legitimate. I mean, $35 million is a ton of money for any documentary film.
Now, here's the thing. Is the opposition film like, mediocre China?
At number 14 is the Indian film Bajrangi Bhaijaan. My Brother Bajrangi, basically. Very popular film. Came out 5 years in India. Someone in China just said, hey, people are loving these Indian films. Let's grab one of the most popular ones. They did. It never got a proper release. Now it has. So it made another $8 million this weekend. It's at $103 million worldwide.
That's like finding money in your pocket. It's like, oh, look, a $5 bill. Another $8 million. I mean, it's made like, I don't even know how much money.
$3 million worldwide.
Yeah, no. But I mean, I think in China, it's made like, I think $20 million so far. So
Yeah. It's very well. Hugh Jackman's The Greatest Showman should end up hitting $400 million. 50 Shades Freed is just about done. That'll probably end up at $370, $380 million. Three Billboards will hit $150 million. And then we get to a movie I could not figure out. I don't know if you did. I think it's being released internationally by Universal. It's in one territory. It's called I Lose Weight.
No, but I'd like to thank you for sending me on a wild goose chase that took me like an hour and a half, and I couldn't find anything on this film.
All I keep getting is weight loss videos. So now when I go to YouTube, they're like, Michael, get in shape. Michael, eat wheat germ. Michael, stop eating so much. It's so annoying, but it grossed $5.8 million, whatever it is. Hey, if you know what this movie is, I Lose Weight, being released by Universal somewhere in the world, making okay money, depending on how much it costs to make, let us know.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also reach out on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox, or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. We do check the messages that are left there.
That's right. That brings us to another new film. It's The Hurricane Heist. Bit of a hard fall for Rob Cohen. He launched the Fast and Furious franchise along with a bunch of other movies. And this latest film is about a bank heist during a hurricane. So The Hurricane Heist is well named, but it really got poor reviews. It's only made $6 million on its opening weekend. So a very poor result for that movie in nine territories. I think it's a $30 million budget, so it's not a big budget film, but the way it just was sort of dumped and came and went and no one paid attention, kind of a sad situation for one of the bigger popular directors of the last few years. Maybe doing a little bit better is The Body. This is a South Korean psychological thriller. It's about the body of a woman disappearing from a morgue. It's a remake of a Spanish film. This film might be called The Vanishing now. It's called, the Spanish film was called The Body. This film I saw listed as The Body on ComScore, but I think in South Korea it's actually now been redubbed The Vanishing. So I'm a little confused by that, but it grossed $4.5 million, whatever you call it. And, you know, two different countries have remade it. Maybe the U.S. will remake it too. There will be no sequel for Helen Mirren's new film, Winchester. That's made $40 million worldwide, but it just doesn't lend itself to a franchise or a spinoff or a sequel. But it cost $3.5 million to make. It's grossed $40 million worldwide. So that's a success story for the movie and for Mirren, who has another film out in North America called The Leisure Seeker. It's her and Donald Sutherland. He has dementia. She's his loving wife, and they go on one last road trip. So it's sort of an elegiac, sort of on Golden Pond type movie with two old people facing mortality and dementia and the end of life. That's doing, in very limited release, doing pretty limited business. It certainly can't compare to The Death of Stalin. The Death of Stalin is a very independent film. It's being released by IFC. It was banned in Russia. It's a very broad comedy. It's by Armando Iannucci, who the creator of In the Loop and Veep. It had a huge opening weekend in North America. Four screens, $45,000 per screen, which is the best of the year so far, only bested by Black Panther. And it's the second best ever opening ever for IFC. So that movie, which I would not have expected to really catch fire like that, at least in a very limited release, has started off very strongly and gotten very good reviews. I would say less so for Gringo. This is a light comedy about a man with a marijuana pill that he's delivering to people, and he gets kidnapped by a drug cartel in Mexico. It stars David Oyelowo, Charlize Theron, and it was made by Amazon Studios. And I'm aware of it because MoviePass was pushing this baby hard.
Yeah, so it looks like if you wanted to know which studios were actually using MoviePass to promote their films, now, of course, MoviePass is not saying which studios are promoting through their platform.
Well, we know they bought ads because it was part of their ad campaign.
Now, I don't know whether it was Amazon Studios or whether it was STX, because Amazon Studios is, like, say, the production company, and then they distribute through Lionsgate or STX or, you know, Roadside Attractions. So STX may be doing the marketing here. But STX or Amazon is definitely promoting their films this particular film, very heavily on television and very heavily on digital and, of course, through MoviePass.
And sadly, it didn't work.
No, not at all. Although the trailer makes it look like a fun film, it also makes it look like they put all the good parts in the trailer.
But we have other information about MoviePass, don't we?
Well, I don't know. Where do you want to start with MoviePass, other than the fact that, they start tracking you from your house, apparently?
Yeah, they say they're boasting about it. They were talking to people, pitching the movie pass and what the benefits are. And the guy's like, yeah, of course we track them. We track people before they use the app, after they use the app. We follow the route they take to the movie theater and where they go home, where they stop. And the idea is, hey, we see you go by this restaurant, or we can make a whole evening out. You can get a discount here at this restaurant, go to the movie theater. We can tell you're passing by the grocery store on the way home. Maybe you want to give them a little ad to say, hey, pick up some fresh vegetables or milk. You know, they just think it's great. We're going to make your whole movie going experience even better.
Well, you know, here's the thing. I sometimes wonder if Mitch Lowe, who is the CEO of MoviePass now, after taking over from Stacey Spikes, who was a guest on this show right when MoviePass launched. He was the founder of the show and the first CEO, and he came on the show and told us all about it way back in 2012. And now Mitch Lowe came in. He's a former co-founding executive, so he was one of the first executives at Netflix. He was the head of Redbox for a while, and now he's heading up MoviePass. I sometimes wonder if he speaks out of turn and from a point where he doesn't necessarily know what is actually accurate. And so,
accurate?
Well, meaning that they do track you, but I think they track you once you launch the app, because you have to launch the app, be within 100 yards of the movie theater to purchase the ticket.
But no, you actually launch the app when you're at home before you go out. You know, I'm checking the movie time, making sure it's available, doing all that sort of stuff. So I don't even use Fandango or movie listings to see what the movie times are on the day I'm going. I just use MoviePass. And you also want to make sure it's available. They put up a little notice to you when you launch MoviePass, and it says, hey, We want to remind you to always double check the MoviePass app to confirm your preferred showtimes and theaters are available for the movie you're planning to see before you leave for the theater. That's not a trick to let them track you. That's them saying, hey, sorry about that whole Red Sparrow thing, Los Angeles, because, of course, a lot of people showed up to the movie theater not having launched MoviePass in advance and said, what the hell? Where's Red Sparrow? Why can't I see this movie?
Yeah, well, then they had to have a, you know, I guess everybody was up in arms because the article appeared on TechCrunch. You know, this is what I mean by Mitch Lowe talking and sometimes boasting about things that he may not know exactly what, the ins and outs of the technology behind it. And, of course, everybody was up in arms. The post on TechCrunch went viral and, oh, my God, MoviePass.
It sounded like they knew what you had for breakfast.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And so then the official statement. Should I read the official statement? Do you care or not?
Whatever you think is useful.
Well, you tell me whether they have denied that they're tracking you. They say, we are exploring utilizing location-based marketing as a way to help enhance the overall experience by creating more opportunities for our subscribers to enjoy all the various elements of a good movie night. We will not be selling the data that we gather. Rather, we will use it to better inform how to market potential customer benefits, including discounts on transportation, coupons for nearby restaurants, and other similar opportunities. And that is the end of their statement. And Michael, as you kind of defined that already, right? But
it sounds like they're saying, yes, we do track you.
Yes,
and
exactly.
We're not going to sell your data and information, but you're going to love it. We're going to give you a coupon for that restaurant you go by on your way to the movie theater.
And what I would say is this. Hey, look, okay, you're in most markets, you're paying for $9.99 a month in all markets. And in most markets, you would need to pay $12, $13, $14 for a movie ticket.
I wouldn't say most markets because the average movie price is like $8 and change.
Okay, so even so you see one or two movies, you've already, gotten your money's worth. So in that,
which is more than most people go to movies in a year.
Correct. That said, when you are not paying anything, when something is free, or when something is being heavily subsidized, there is a reason for it, and more often than not, you are the product, meaning your actions, your behavior is being sold to others.
Yeah, well, it's not being sold yet. We understand that, whether it's just that they're saying, oh gosh, we have to make money somewhere. So this may be one of the ways we do it.
And my question to you, Michael, is do you care?
The people who are upset, I say, guess what? Your website tracks you. Someone said Facebook tracks you when you go around the internet. I'm like, as does most every other site.
Right.
So, yes, Facebook does that. You may not like it, but that is hardly unusual. It's stupid of them to have presented it in this way. They wouldn't want to talk about it until they had something useful to offer. Like, hey, we have these free discounts. When you launch the app, we know where you're going. We know you're nearby this restaurant, so we want to offer it. Instead of making it positive, it's just to present it as Big Brother is watching you. So they didn't get this information out in a good way. Like you say, he shouldn't have talked about it. They had something positive to say. Like, hey, you get a free discount at the movies. Guess what? Now we want to offer you a free discount at restaurants nearby. And we've got an actual thing to offer rather than just, yeah, we're watching your every move. And someday you may not mind so much.
Yeah. Now, keep in mind, remember that kerfuffle a couple weeks ago when there was the whole thing about how people's movie passes were being canceled for breaking the terms of service. Well, one of those terms of service was that you had to stay for the whole movie. And now why is that? Okay.
It makes no sense since they say one of the benefits of movie passes is that you can leave early if you don't like the movie. No big loss.
Well, right. But here's the thing. When you have 2 million subscribers, you're going to get some fraud. Okay. Not all 2 million people will commit fraud, but you'll get a percentage of fraud. And they finally have some fraud detection going on. And what they found is some people, not everybody and not a majority of their customers, but a small minority of their customers are going to the movie theater, buying a ticket and then reselling it to somebody who's showing up for the movie. Okay. And that's their way of making money. Okay. So they'll do that once a day, every day.
They have not offered a bit of evidence that is happening. That's just pure supposition.
Well, that's
no evidence to that whatsoever. None. Zero. Because you'd be making so little money if you actually went physically to a movie theater once a day. You'd make like $60 a week. You know, that's a pretty bad scam. And they have not said, here, we've caught these people. They're being arrested. There's no evidence of this whatsoever. I don't know anybody doing this. I haven't heard rumors of this. It's just a pure fantasy idea. And the fact is that you can turn the app off. If you turn the app off, as I often do, because I just, whatever, they don't know that you've left early. And B, they say you can leave early because that's the best thing about the movie.
Right. So the GPS tracking is how they were determining.
But not if you turn the app off.
Yeah, that's the issue. That's where people are wondering, well, how do you know I turn my phone off when I go into the movie theater? So how do you know if I've done that? And so there's exception tracking and all. I mean, look, we could get into the tech details.
Well, you're saying if you take an app and you actually physically close the app, they can still track you?
Oh, like, absolutely. Yeah.
Like you turn it off completely and don't allow tracking with the app. There's ways.
Well, if you're not allowing tracking when the app is closed, then technically they should not be tracking you. Now, also keep this in mind, that their business plan is infinitely reproducible. Okay.
No, their business plan doesn't exist. Their business plan is, in the future, we will make money somehow in a way we have yet to determine. That is their business plan. Well, we are losing money every day. And our plan is, eventually, we believe the theater chains will give us some of that box office, or give us some of the merchandising, or give us some of the popcorn, or studios will pay us to tell them who's going to the movies, or restaurants will give us money for, you know, it's like, it's all just pie in the sky future stuff.
Well,
it's
okay.
But yes, there is no business plan from MoviePass today.
Well, like Bitcoin, okay, or any one of these,
Bitcoin is not a business.
Any one of these, you know what? I'm just trying to get to the point where I get to mention that over on Celluloid Junkie, Patrick Von Sikowski had a post about something called CPass, okay, which is actually a MoviePass for the United Kingdom. So they've just literally replicated the entire business. Now, whether they're profitable or not is another story. For £9.95 per month, you know, it's unlimited movie going. What I'm trying to say is it's not as if somebody couldn't come along and do the exact same thing.
Well, why would they want to? Why would you want to lose billions of dollars a year? It's like, hey, I can create a losing business. Yes, a gym is not a unique idea. A pass to go to the movies is not a unique idea. Other people may reproduce it, but I assuming is there anything about CPass that is different where they are actually partnered with studios or theater chains where they might actually not lose money with every customer?
No, not at all.
Okay, so yes, you and I could launch a movie pass and lose money. We can make it $5 a month. We could have even more people. So what?
I wonder if we could make enough money to buy Miramax. Not Miramax, the Weinstein Company.
the Miramax. You're so old.
Now, by the way, I used MoviePass, okay, to see some of the Academy Award nominated films, actually.
So did I.
And I actually wound up seeing The Shape of Water, although I paid for it because I wanted to go see it at the Arclight Cinemas because, you know, they have like great projection and great sound. And so I actually paid for that one.
Oh, I don't want to go to the premium theaters at all. The one thing I'll say, the people say they don't make movies like they used to. You know, that's what they love to say all the time. They don't make movies for adults. They don't make movies like they used to. Well, I just don't think that's true. I mean, you look at a lot of the Academy Award nominations. 8 of the 9 films up for Best Picture made a lot of money. You know, not Marvel comic money, but they were all very profitable, especially based on their budget. Every single darn one of them, along with, Greatest Showman and some other movies in the Tech Awards. So those are all movies geared towards adults, basically. 3 Billboards, Lady Bird, The Shape of Water, Call Me By Your Name, and so on. And Dunkirk, Darkest Hour. These are all movies for adults, and they all made money. And I think that's something that if you're talking about, why don't they have more popular? Well, you know what? They all were popular. They all made money. None of them except Dunkirk are on my best of the year list. But, you know, a lot of people liked them critically as well. So, you know, let's just credit Hollywood where it is. The Oscars would tend to focus on movies, you know, that are good, that people liked. And I think they sort of did that.
Okay. Well, you know, every year we have this debate. Well, every year since what, 2009, we've had this debate about this preferential ballot, okay? Which is, you know, if you pick 10 films, divide by 3, it's raining in Detroit, and it's an odd year, then the last film goes. And all of its votes go to the number 8 film. You know, it's ridiculous. So, and we've had this argument of, you know, our films getting screwed. Okay, I'm going to use the word screwed. So we're now an explicit podcast. Right. That said, you've done some research here and you've said, oh, look, maybe that's not true. At least, 60% of the time, it may not be true.
Well, hold on. I felt a little off my footing last week when we talked about the Oscars. I should have questioned you guys a little bit more. Two things. You guys are unhappy with the movie that won Best Picture.
And we you're should blaming... say it's me and Ann Thompson from IndieWire right. when you say you guys.
Right. Or people in general are unhappy with the movie that won Best Picture, and they're blaming preferential balloting. They think that this was not the first movie across the... For all we know, The Shape of Water received a majority of the votes. You know, you have no idea. For all we know, that movie won Best Picture just like it would have won it if there'd only been straightforward first past the post balloting. Or it might have won if there'd only been five films rather than 10. But you're unhappy with the Best Picture winner. You just don't like the sense that you don't know whether that's the most popular film.
Correct.
That bothers you.
Correct. Well, not only that, but you find yourself seeing like, well, are films getting split? Like, you know, are our votes getting split? So with you know, the year that 2015, when Spotlight came out of nowhere to win Best Picture, you kind of wonder, did Revenant and Boyhood split the vote and Spotlight just kind of wind up where like Spotlight was on number three on everybody's list? And so therefore, because it was number three, and some people...
You end up with the least disliked movie rather than the most passionately loved
movie. Correct.
Right. Well, two things I wanted to say. One, I think complaints about the movie that wins Best Picture are historic.
Yes,
it didn't start
true.
In 2009.
No.
Two, I have a couple points. Preferential balloting was first used when? Was it 2009?
No, actually, I think... Wasn't it actually... Like, didn't they pick this up again from like... The early 20s or 30, not the early
That's 20s, right.
the late 20s.
1934 through 1945, preferential balloting was first used. For the first, you know, for 11 years during the heyday of the Hollywood studio system, preferential balloting was used, along with often like 10 films for Best Picture. So when people bit, oh, we can't have 10 films, it'll look like we're scrambling to find a 10th film. I'm like, there's 10 films worth mentioning for the Oscars. It's not that hard. I don't look at the list of movies, even though, you know, only two of them would even remotely be on my best of the year list. I don't look at the list of nine films and go, oh my God, that shouldn't be on there. That shouldn't be on there. Mostly people say, I wish this had also been on there, you know, so I don't think that's the case. So preferential balloting is as old as the Oscars. They did it for a decade. 10 films on the list is as old as the Oscars. That's what it was for a long time. So that five films is not some magical number. But the biggest thing is you feel like preferential balloting is screwing up. The film that deserves to win is not winning. But if you look at the last, you know, since we've been doing this in 2009, like we said, six out of nine times, basically the front runner or one of the front runners has won. The Hurt Locker won in 2009. It had nine nominations, tied with Avatar. The King's Speech won in 2010. It had the most nominations. The Artist had 10 nominations, while Hugo had 11. So it was clearly a front runner. 12 Years a Slave had nine nominations, right behind American Hustle and Gravity. They had 10. Birdman had nine nominations, the most of that year, tied with Grand Budapest Hotel. The Shape of Water this year, the most nominations, 13. Nobody else was even close. It won Best Picture. Now, the movie that has the most nominations should not automatically win Best Picture, but hey, yeah, it's a pretty good indication that it was a popular film, a lot of people liked it, and it was a front runner. So if most of the time, two-thirds of the time, the front runner wins, I don't know what the problem is with preferential balloting.
Yeah, although if you have two heavy favorites, right, and given the way preferential balloting works, you have to have 50% of the vote. Okay, in the number one.
To win, clear out, yeah.
No, meaning that you let's say there's eight films, okay, and the number eight doesn't have 50%.
Right, then its second choice goes up to the top one. Yeah,
Yeah. So then it basically rolls up. So that's how a film in second place could wind up with a whole bunch of votes that it never actually received. And beat out.
No. Everybody votes on the movies. They all have votes they receive. If you can't win right outright, then the lowest voting movie disappears, and your second vote goes to the movie. Your first pick is, you know, is Gravity, and your second pick is 12 Years a Slave. Well, that's how, you know, a lot of people, most people at 12 Years a Slave, number two. Why are we getting into the balloting system? We know how it works.
You're the one who brought it up.
I'm talking about the results. You want to go through a list of how balloting works? If your favorite, if the film that had the least amount of votes doesn't win, then that's cut off, and the second choice of the people who voted for that movie becomes their first choice. Okay, so what? It's preferential balloting. It's not complicated. List your movies in the order you love them, and hopefully your favorite film or your second favorite film will win.
I feel about preferential balloting the same way I feel about the Electoral College.
The Electoral College means the most popular movie didn't win. That's the problem with the Electoral College, that two of our last three presidents have been people who lost the popular vote. I don't like that.
Well, you know what? I'm sure now that we've bored our listeners to tears over this issue.
You make a good point. The most popular film has won most of the time under preferential balloting. It's been going on since the Oscars began. I don't know why I'm bitching about it, since, as you point out, the film with the most nominations or considered a front runner has usually won. So why do I have such animus towards it? You're right, Michael. I've had a Road to Damascus moment. Well, how do you feel about The Sopranos? Did you like the way The Sopranos ended?
Forget about it.
So maybe you'll be happy to see how The Sopranos began. Because this week in reboots, we've got The Sopranos, the movie. Yes, they're going to make a movie. David Chase has co-written the script. He's going to produce. And it's a prequel set in the 1960s during the Newark riots, which means there's going to be a call out for someone to play Tony Soprano when he's in his 20s, I guess.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, I don't know why they have to base it on The Sopranos, because I guess everything has to be,
The Sopranos. What do you mean base it on? It's only The Sopranos. What do you mean? How can they not base a movie about The Sopranos on The Sopranos?
No, why can't they just say, hey, this is a 1960s gangster movie set amidst the Newark riots?
It's not. It's The Sopranos. It's not a gangster movie randomly set during the riots and they decide, well, let's just make it at The Sopranos. It's about Tony Soprano specifically, the character we know and then followed through all those years and know will go into therapy and all that happens to him. We see how he began. It's not any old Joe. It's Tony Soprano.
Right, but why does it have to be Tony Soprano?
It's about Tony Soprano. It can't be anything but Tony. What do you mean? We made this story about Michael Giltz earlier. Why does it have to be Michael Giltz? Because it's young Albert Einstein, young Abraham Lincoln. Well, why couldn't it be somebody else? Because it's about young Abraham Lincoln. That's why, the man who would go on to be president. It can't be about anybody else, because that's what the movie is about. As again, I don't want to see the movie. I think they're just going back to the well. Does David Chase really feel driven to tell this story?
I'm trying to say.
Well, but that's not what you're saying. You're saying, why does a movie about Tony Soprano have to be about Tony Soprano?
No, here's what I'm saying. Why do you have to make a movie, okay, that is set amidst the Newark riots, that features mafiosa... features mafiosa set amidst the Newark riots in the 1960s. Why do you have to put known characters in there? Why couldn't you create other world?
They're not putting known characters in there. It's the story of Tony Soprano. It's like saying this young guy who chops wood and studies law by candlelight and go, why does it have to be Abraham Lincoln? Because that's his story. It's literally Tony Soprano.
Why couldn't it be somebody else?
Some other young maiden who goes off and hears the call of God and leads France to war and victory over England. I don't know. Why does it have to be Joan of Arc? Why does it have to be Jon Favreau making a movie for Star Wars? Jon Favreau is going to write and executive produce one of those live action Star Wars TV series that's going to be on the Disney streaming app service. On the plus side, he was involved in the TV series Clone Wars, which I thought was very good, actually. And he did work on the Han Solo film that is coming out soon this summer.
Here's my question. Who didn't work on the Han Solo film that's coming out this year?
I don't know. I didn't work on it. Did you work on it?
No, but I'm going to see it, which is kind of, I feel like I'm working on it.
Hey, you're feeling you're working on it. On the downside, Jon Favreau is a white male.
Okay. They're not supposed to work anymore. I see right here in the newspaper, it says right here, white male's not supposed to work anymore.
Well, okay, that's white males dominate. So, again, the idea that it shouldn't work anymore, like they're being cut out of all jobs when like other people are just saying, we'd like to work too. So maybe Jon Favreau, who's got a busy schedule and he's doing the Jungle Book movie and he's done many Marvel films and he's doing other work. Is he the guy you need to do a Star Wars TV series?
And what Disney would say is, hey, we're spending a lot of money on this. Jon Favreau is one of our trusted and valuable employees who has directed several hit films for us. We know him. We like him. We know what he will deliver. And like any employer who wants to make sure one of their products gets off the manufacturing line in good order, we're hiring the person we know and like.
And that's how Sperling becomes a trending topic on the Me Too movement.
But that's basically what, that's the excuse.
Yes,
you hear.
We know, we've worked with them and we're going to keep working with them, which is how women and people of color never get jobs. Of course it is. You stick with the people you've already worked with and the people they recommend, and then that's all you ever have. It's true. You're absolutely right. I mean, when I first saw it, I said, oh, that's cool, because I liked the work he did on Clone Wars. So I thought, well, that's a positive. He's worked in the Star Wars universe. He's done a good project. Maybe this one will be good, too. And then other people said, yeah, same old with Star Wars and Jon Favreau. It's kind of funny, given the recent films having been dominated in the front of the camera by women and people of color. That's a really notable part of the new Star Wars film. But, yeah, they make an interesting point.
Well, now, you mentioned at the top of the show that we would be talking about how Fox is going to be joining NBC and reducing ad clutter. And I guess, is it cord cutting or just the realization that an hour-long TV show shouldn't have, like, say, half an hour of ads crammed into it? In any case, Fox is taking a cue from NBC Universal. That company pledged to reduce ad clutter by 20% across all of its networks. Fox is doing the same slowly. They plan to reduce ads per hour by a total of 2 minutes. And you might ask, well, when are they doing this? And it's going to be done in the next 2 years. Now, wait. Stop the presses. Did we say they were cutting 2 minutes of ads from each hour of TV? Well, forgive us for misreading a headline. In fact, Fox plans to have only 2 minutes of ads per hour. 2 minutes
of ads. Only 2 minutes of ads. Instead of 13 or 14 minutes, they're only going to have 2 minutes.
Yes. And so by 2020... that's when that will occur. Currently, the networks have about 13 minutes of ad time per hour. So they're going to be cutting 11 minutes of ads. That would be about 75%, a 75% reduction in ads. Obviously, they would charge more for the ads that remain, one would assume. This was first reported by the Wall Street Journal to a private industry gathering is where this came out.
Right. So my immediate thought was what that would mean in practical terms. And your thought was, immediately about, yeah, you guys have been a little too greedy and now you realize you need to cut back.
Well, yeah, because for years, I mean, if you go all the way back to the start of television, you had, I Love Lucy brought to you by Winston. You know, you had sponsored shows, right? And I don't know whether I Love Lucy was one of them. I just picked one. And then you had advertising come along where it wasn't a show being sponsored by one, manufacturer. It was, ad sponsored. And then, over the past 10, 15 years, you've had advertising and retransmission fees. So you basically ask people to pay $2, $3, $4 per month for the right to view the channel on their cable or satellite subscription, even though it was bundled together and you had no idea how much you were paying for that broadcast channel, which, by the way, you could receive free over the air. And you also were kind of forced to watch ads on that same network. And now what the networks are realizing is, wow, people like paying $9.99 per month to watch content where there are no ads. And so they're basically paying their own retransmission fee and they don't get ads. We have to be more like that.
I love how you give the history of television when you were discussing the new move by Fox News. And speaking of history, it was Philip Morris sponsored the I Love Lucy show. So that was the cigarette sponsor of I Love Lucy.
I knew it was a cigarette. I just couldn't remember which one.
Mm-hmm. They're making tons of money from TV ads. CBS did boast recently that, hey, 40% of their ad revenue comes from ads. Pardon me. 40% of their total revenue comes from ads only. And they said 10 years ago, that used to be 70% of our revenue. So they're either making more money from a lot of other areas or they're making less money from ads. Which is it? Are they making more money in other new areas?
I think they probably are making more money from other new areas. I think they're also retransmission fees. I think they're also kind of earning less money from advertising because digital is beginning to eat away at some of the money that was allotted to television ads, although the upfronts are very healthy every year. So it's
So why would Fox do this? Well, they're not doing it out of, are they trying to be proactive and say, hey, we realize we're screwing up and so many people are DVRing and binging that we need to change now and get ahead of the curve?
I think there's that, and they're being proactive about it. I also think that they're planning on getting more money for the ads that remain by also targeting those ads to specific people. Remember that.
Well, they're going to be on network, so then how can they target them? We're not talking about online.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder, if that's, over time, they'll be able to slip in ads that are directed to a specific household. I mean, this might be 5-10 years down the road.
That's, I mean, that's just pure fantasy.
You couldn't make that decision today.
Right. That's not part of the plan. They're reducing it to 2 minutes an hour for the network. You know, there were going to be ads for like a film or in a car, stuff like that. It's not going to be a targeted ad to your household, I don't think.
And I guess maybe they're hoping that, you know, for those 2 minutes, you'll actually pay attention. Because I will tell you this, that when I'm watching, whether it's AP Bio, I think is what I've been watching online, it's only, you know, there's four ads, so it's 2 minutes. So there's maybe 6 minutes of ads in a 30-minute show.
That's a lot. That's 12 minutes an ad in an hour. That's just like what you got in prime time right now.
Right. And so, you know, I will watch the first ad block. It's 2 minutes. Now, my problem with the whole thing is they repeat the ad block just, you know, 10 minutes later.
But if you're watching online, I thought you couldn't skip it.
You can't. But then you're not choosing to watch it.
You have no choice.
Right. But I will actually watch the first two minutes. Then, like, the second time it rolls around, I'll go check email while it's playing.
Well, that's why they keep repeating them, I guess, because they know half the time you'll be away. But anyway, your thought was, this isn't going to happen anytime soon, and it actually won't happen in the way they think, because that's crazy. My thought was, wow, what would happen if it actually occurred? My first thought was sports. You know how many ads and breaks there are in baseball and football? One reason the games are so long is because there are so many damn TV ads. Sometimes you sit in the stadium, and you're waiting for the TV ad to finish so the player can take a bat. And it's in a 3.5-hour game, so you really get annoyed. But I'm guessing that if they did do this, they would not be cutting ads in a live sporting event.
No, because that's the only time that they actually have your rapt attention.
And people are paying. Yeah, people are actually watching. And what about local ads? That doesn't mean local stations get none, does it? Because they get some ads every hour on primetime, too.
Yes, that's true. And so when they say they're cutting it down to two minutes of ads per hour, they mean their ads. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's 2 minutes of their ads per hour that they're selling.
And would the networks have to pay for longer episodes? Because right now you've got TV dramas that run like 45, 43 minutes, 47 minutes long in an hour long slot. Well, that's very different than if they suddenly say, okay, we need 54 minutes. You know, that's an extra 8 minutes of TV time. That adds up.
Yeah, so there'll be more dialogue, maybe? I don't know. More character development?
And also, if they did have just sponsorships at the beginning and the end, would it be a pure run of 50 minutes of just drama, just like you would get if you streamed it? Would they put one ad drop right in the middle? Because that creates a lot of new creative challenges and opportunities. I mean, it's a very, very different job to create an hour-long show for HBO, where it's just an uninterrupted, versus a show where you know you're going to have 3 or 4 breaks.
I think what you'll also get is you'll get a lot of product placement. Okay, mm-hmm. You'll also get these ad breaks that aren't really ad breaks. So they're like, you know, they're off to the side. Meaning you see it in sports a lot. You know, you saw it during the Olympics a lot, where you know the actual broadcast was reduced to a smaller window, and off to the right you'd see the ad or whatever was being pitched to you.
Well, and, you know, you've got the damn ad for the network on the entire night, you know, NBC or, you know, This Is Us or Next Week or, you know, that sort of thing. Little things pop up while you're watching a show, which I find very annoying. But they've already got a presence on the screen, you know, pretty much the entire hour to begin with. So if it popped up and said Coca-Cola, but would that count as reducing ad time if you, you know, slapped an ad for Coca-Cola on the bottom of a screen?
Maybe.
As far as they're concerned, it would. But more likely the cast of This Is Us would be drinking Pepsi.
Or
whatever it may be, you know. So they're going to pay for that product placement ahead of having a banner ad across the bottom of the screen, I think.
Well, you know what as I mentioned, some of the money that it used to go to TV is being kind of siphoned off by other mediums. And on the radio show Market Foolery, it's a radio show and podcast, host Chris Hill was talking to Motley Fool Asset Management's Bill Barker. And I only mention this because of the punchline here. Mm-hmm. And they were talking about advertising and how it's in a state of flux now. And Bill Barker said, look, online is disrupting TV. Bill Barker from Motley Fool said, yeah, well, TV is not as easy of a vehicle to distribute your advertising, whether it's great or not, as it used to be, because it's all podcasts now. And Chris Hill said, yeah, it's all about podcast.
On a podcast.
On a podcast.
And now we're talking about it.
On a podcast.
Yes, but we have about 10,000 listeners as opposed to 10 million people who tuned into the new season of American Idol.
Oh, okay. So that just came in.
Yeah, yeah. It's about 10 million people in the overnights, it looks like. I think it would be a pretty good show for DVR pickup because it's not a live episode. So there might be a couple million people added in for DVR. I know that's how I watched it, though I watched it within an hour of its airing. And a nice solid start, basically where they picked off 2 years ago. You know, Pink was a lot of fun. And if you liked American Idol, it's exactly the same. They have not tweaked the formula except for downplaying the losers, the people who just go on for attention, which I never liked and was always annoyed by. So I'm glad that that has mostly stopped. But it's basically the same heartland, sentimental, flag waving, heart tugging TV show you remember.
Well, what about the fact that it was at 22 million viewers at its height?
That was a decade ago. Yeah, I mean, The Voice is only at 12 million. So, you know, it's right.
All right. So basically what you're saying is that, you know, everything got diluted and yeah, so they're basically at the height of where they can be right now.
Right. I mean, they could get bigger if it's, you know, so the live shows became electric or something. But as far as what they promised advertisers, and while the celebs on the show are getting a lot of money, they reduced a lot of other fees that the show had towards the end of its run, and therefore they're able to make it profitable right off the bat. What they promised advertisers, they're already delivering with this debut episode, so they're well within where they need to be in order to make it profitable, or so they say.
Well, now, we promised our listeners at the top of the show that we would tell them about a few new books that were kind of ready for their close-up. And every week, Michael, you tell us about some books that are ripe for the optioning, ripe for being transformed into TV shows or movies. And you do this because you pick books that we should be reading on bookfilter.com each week. What have you got for us this week, Michael?
Well, this week I have three books. One is a cookbook, two are novels. The first one is The Flicker of Old Dreams by Susan Henderson. It feels sort of like a modern day Last Picture Show. So if you know that movie or the novel by Larry McMurtry, you know what I mean. It's set in a crumbling small town where the local mortician, a young woman, befriends an outcast who has returned to town to care for his dying mother. It's just got that vibe about it. Great reviews, a talented author who's just on the cusp of breaking out. But then there's a cookbook, which seems like an odd thing, but it's also a memoir, and it's by Alon Shaya. And the cookbook is called Shaya. And it's the story of his journey from like Israel to the U.S. to where he ended up in New Orleans. And he was mixing the cuisine of his home country, Israel, with the spice of Louisiana. And he ended up opening three hugely acclaimed restaurants, including Domenica, Pizza Domenica, and Shaya, all of which are really high on the list of some of the best restaurants in the country. And it's just a fascinating combination of who he is and how he got there. And the idea of a Jew in New Orleans making Jewish food, combining it with, you know, gumbo and bam and all that, just is an intriguing, fun combination. And then there's a book that sort of taps into the faith-based film movement, as I see it, though I think it's a cut above that. It's called Anatomy of a Miracle by Jonathan Miles. And it's about a paraplegic who inexplicably recovers. And suddenly he becomes the center of a media frenzy, medical confusion, and an investigation by the Vatican into whether a miracle has actually occurred. So it's not a pure faith-based film in the sense of we're going to just comfort you with what you believe, but it's in that world, and it's not negative about faith either. But this guy maybe is a military vet. It's a very modern, smart book. Jonathan Miles is a really terrific author. He's gotten great reviews for several of his other books. They've also been pretty darn popular. So he's on the cusp of becoming a bigger name. This book's getting great reviews. And ultimately what I decided is that when I couldn't pick which of these three books should be made into a project, I realized that none of them were good ideas.
What? Wait, you just gave us three ideas?
And all of them are good ideas, and all of them are bad ideas. They're all sorts of, you know, when you look at a book, you that make a great movie. What matters is that somebody approaches it and gets passionate about it. Any one of these could be a great project. Any one of these could be just, what were you thinking? Any one of these could languish forever. The only real pick that matters is one that you personally are passionate about and think, oh my God, I have to make this movie. So any one of them that speaks to a young filmmaker or speaks to a veteran who says, oh my God, this taps into me so much, then yes, then it's a possibility. And that's true for so many books, I think. So, I mean, when you talk about a great project or a great property, it's only great when somebody who loves it and knows the right way to make it stumbles onto it. So that was sort of my minor insight, because some weeks I know, this is the one that I would make. Other weeks, I can't decide between two or three which one I should promote. And that was where I was this week. And I realized, you know what? What matters is not me or the project, but that some filmmaker says, I know how to do this and I want to do this and I need to do this. And then it could be a great film.
Which is what we do every week when we do our show. We need to do it.
That's right. We need to do it. And Shakespeare and Company needs to expand. A little good news in the book world. Shakespeare and Company, a small independent chain, is going to add 3 new stores. 2 more in Manhattan, including the Upper West Side, which is my favorite neighborhood in a way. 69th and 70th Street on Broadway. Another store down in the Village. And then another store in another city. And their idea is they're going to stick to sort of the sweet spot of 3,000 square feet, which is pretty darn small. They're going to have a carefully curated collection, which is another way of saying not a lot of books. They're going to have a cafe, and they're going to have an espresso machine. But by an espresso machine, they mean their on-demand printing machine, for where they can say, oh, the book's not in the store. We can print it for you in a couple minutes, or we can help you self-publish your book. So it's good news when a well-done store or chain wants to expand. Shakespeare and Company is doing it slowly but surely. They're finally gearing up to actually open up 3 new stores this year. So that's interesting. It's good news. And, you know, but 3,000 square feet, you need about 10 of them to equal a regular Barnes & Noble.
Now, is the Barnes, I'm trying to remember if the Broadway, several of them were located on Broadway, but when I went to NYU, there was one at 716 Broadway, and it had like the gold lettering, Shakespeare & Company. I think it was one of the first ones that they had. It was several stories, and is it, that's still?
That one is still there, I believe.
Okay, yeah, because I felt like I walked past and it was like a Foot Locker or a McDonald's or something. And I was like, wow, okay, they couldn't make it.
Well,
okay.
Yeah, there's always a McDonald's right near it, but I think that one is still there.
Okay. Well, I guess we also mentioned at the top of the show that we would be talking about Sherman Alexie during our sexual misconduct of Palooza. And of course, again, we're not making fun of the sexual misconduct. We just tagged our segment, Sexual Misconduct of Palooza. And
you, you don't have to say that every week, I don't think.
I don't think so, yeah, but you know. But what if somebody's tuning in for the first time and they go, oh, the nerve of them. This week we're talking about author Sherman Alexie, who is declining a top award amidst some past misconduct allegations.
Not allegations so much as people talking about things that their relationship with him or what happened. He declined the Carnegie Medal for nonfiction. They gave it to him for his memoir, You Don't Have to Say You Love Me, which is terrific. One of my favorite books of the year. I highly recommend it. He said, I'm not going to take the award. And they said, okay, we're just not going to give it out this year. That was their decision. His publisher also said they're going to delay the release of his book in paperback. They're not going to put out You Don't Have to Say You Love Me right now in paperback. They're delaying the release. At some point, someday they will, of course, but they're not going to do it right now. And he said in a statement, once these women came forward and instead of being anonymous, they went on the record talking to NPR and others. Mostly it was about women that he hit on. That he said, oh, hey, I love your poetry. Send me more poetry. But then he ended up just really wanting to have sex with them. So it was an abuse of power in that sense. He is a giant figure in Native American culture, of course, and he's a gatekeeper. You know, if he gives you a blurb, that can help you reach a wider world. It can help you get work in the community that he's in. I mean, it's hugely important. And he said in a statement, quote, I have made poor decisions and I am working hard to become a healthier man who makes healthier decisions, end quote. So while one woman that he used to date, they had a consensual relationship, and she sort of helped publicize the other women. She didn't claim, I don't think, anything improper in his behavior with her, but she just wanted to bring attention to what he'd done. Well, that's he took issue with her, but the other woman, he has not disputed any descriptions that they have made. What bothers me about this is just how people think like, well, we can't read his books anymore. You know,
we could do a whole show on that, but the same thing with you know, do you watch Woody Allen movies? You know, it's
right. Well, it's, in a Woody Allen movie, you might say, "Wow, you know, that movie where that older man sleeps with that really young woman." It disturbs me a little bit more now that I know he's an older man who sleeps with really young women. You know, that might you know. In this case, we're talking about like this novel called "The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian." It's a semi-autobiographical work. It's a mainstay of schools all over the country. It's hardly recommended to kids by librarians for decades now. Like boys who don't like to read, like, hey, read this book. You know, it won the National Book Award. It's just a terrific novel, and it's an incredibly important story, and it's meant so much to so many people. This Native American figure who broke out to a wider audience. It's just a really important work, and I don't think any of that has changed, no matter what bad behavior or misbehavior he's done in his private life. What's so ironic here is that his memoir and this book talk about all the screw-ups he's done in his life. It doesn't mean you're excused if you say, hey, I've done bad things. But really, He talks about, you know, his physical abuse, his sexual abuse as a child, his drug addiction, his alcohol addiction, the same for his parents and all people around him in his world. I mean, it's all about the environment that can create someone who does make unhealthy decisions and does do things that they regret and does do things that they feel bad about, not to excuse them, but to show the world that they grew up in and why that might be. You know, it's just like, if anything, you should absolutely be reading his memoir if you want to understand why somebody might abuse their power or make bad choices or become addicted to, you know, it's like, dear God, this is exactly what you should be reading to understand and empathize and learn, while he's saying, hey, I've screwed up and I don't want to anymore. He had a book tour for this memoir. He canceled it because he has depression issues and suicidal issues. You know, this is not a guy who has ever said, I'm a wonderful, you know, it's not Bill Cosby. So right. It just seems bizarre that he would be shunned and that his books cannot be read when they're about the very issues that need to be discussed. It's very upsetting and confusing to me.
Well, I guess, yeah. I mean, look, they're delaying his paperback. That's a big deal, at least for the publisher and for Sherman Alexie.
Ding, 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 ding.
Oh, yes. Okay. Yes, I didn't mean to, but I did. I guess I moved us into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. I guess I have to watch what I say from now on. Our first story, the musical Hamilton. That's all I need to say. The musical Hamilton. Because whatever it is, it's going to be a big deal. It does indeed play in Peoria. And London, apparently, where the celebration of ungrateful colonists rebelling against king and country has set the box office on fire, ignited critics, and snagged the most nominations ever from the Oliviers, that country's equivalent to the Tonys. It can boast of 13 Olivier nominations, though so many actors are competing against one another that it won't set an all-time record for wins. That continues the trend of commercial shows scoring big with the industry. But beyond Hamilton, it appears that subsidized theater like the National Theater and the Globe and the Royal Shakespeare Company are back in the driver's seat. Just look at the love for Follies, Angels in America, and the film-turned-play Network. Still, the most lauded new play was The Ferryman, and that plans to come to Broadway as soon as possible. Big deal or big whoop.
It's a big deal. I don't think there was any doubt that Hamilton would play in the UK and all over the world. That's what great art does. It speaks in different ways, or, you know, it's like, oh, they won't want to hear about the colonies. It's like, it's silly. But it is good to see that commercial theater is still punching above its weight. The Ferryman, I'm really excited to see that. So whereas for many years recently, the subsidized theater have been, you know, in the driver's seat, it's nice to see that, you know, commercial theater is still helping to do really well at the Oliviers and on the West End. So that's good to see. And you said the Royal Shakespeare Company, which reminded me about Shakespeare and Company. To point out, we do know that Shakespeare and Company is another company that began in Paris. Those yes. Two chains are completely different from the chain that began in the U.S. in 1981. We know that. So keep your cards and letters and phone calls coming.
Now, here in Los Angeles, Hamilton, there was a kerfuffle over, I guess, some politicians and some council. I can't remember. It was in the newspaper over the weekend. They received tickets or they had the ability to buy tickets. I can't remember. They got them early and didn't have to wait in line or wait until the tickets went on sale. And there was a big kerfuffle about that. And I just thought, yeah, they're in the second largest market in the United States. They kind of, you know, there's perks that come with that. One of them is you kind of get to buy tickets ahead of time, or you're given tickets to the hottest show in town.
Doesn't mean people like it.
Yeah, exactly. Now, speaking of things that people don't like, the Church of Scientology, and that's all I'm going to say. No, the Church of Scientology is launching a cable channel. The celebrity-centric religion famously has centers in major cities and offers free introductory courses in auditing. Now, they also offer a cable channel. Scientology TV is launching this week and can be found on satellite service DirecTV, as well as via an app found on Apple TV and Roku. No word yet on what exactly programming will entail, but I guess they got tired of complaining about a cable channel's documentary on the church and so decided, what the heck, they should start their own cable channel. Get it? Own, O-W-N.
Oh.
Get it? Yeah. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. We'll have to see what the programming is like. We know that they've started up like this media service like a year or two ago. They said, hey, we're going to have cameras and studios and stuff. Clearly, they were gearing up for something. This is apparently part of what it was. They talked about it being a TV network. That was some, I think, the headline in Hollywood Reporter. It's like, no. A network is when you have stations all over the country and you broadcast 24 hours a day. And no, this is not that. This is more closer to like an app, or they've got a channel on YouTube. But they do have a channel on DirecTV, which used to be an infomercial channel, by the way, sort of ironically. So I guess it does count as a cable channel, technically.
Yeah. Now, a network means that you have more than one.
There you go. So whether it will be important or good, we'll have to wait and see. It's on Apple and Roku. People can access it. They could have had a channel on YouTube. Would that be worth a thing and big deal? But whoop, I would say, why don't they have a channel on YouTube? You know?
Fox's procedural drama, 911, well, it's been officially renewed for a second season, so it's successful. It has been sold in more than 100 territories globally, including to Sky in the UK. The series, which stars Angela Bassett, Peter Krause, and Connie Britton, has been sold across Europe, Asia, and Latin America by 20th Century Fox Television Distribution. Sky Living has picked up the drama in the UK and will air it later this year. My question is, not only is it Big Deal or Big Whoop, but what number will they use? Big Deal or Big Whoop?
Because it's not 911 in other countries.
No, exactly.
Well, yeah, but it's set in America where that is the number, so that's the number to use. So it makes sense. We would, you know, if it was a drama set about emergency response in Scandinavia, we would learn what the Scandinavian response number was, wouldn't we? They'd be like 474.
You know. Or 999 in the UK.
Oh, is it 999?
I didn't. Yes.
So yeah, so it's all over the world. It's licensed in Canada, Germany, France, Spain, Italy, Portugal, Greece, Belgium, Russia, Sweden, Poland, Finland, on and on and on and on. Two things. One, yet another example of how TV shows are sold all over the world and they make a lot of money and we never hear about it. They never talk about all the money they make from TV shows playing all over the world. That's just a huge black hole of information when it comes to Hollywood and TV shows. Two,
the more you hear about it, the more the production companies have to pay the creatives and the talent. So that's right. One of the reasons. Yeah.
Yeah, it's the main reason. And the second thing is that the showrunner, Tim Minear, is that how you say his name?
I believe so.
Yeah. He was re-upped by Fox, kind of telling, since Ryan Murphy just made a big deal with Netflix, well, here's somebody that the network said, hey, we do not want to lose this guy. So the Fox studio said, please, you're staying with us. And they signed him up. He's been a big partner with Ryan Murphy. He's worked with other people. And this show in particular was his baby. He's had this idea for years. He finally got it up. He finally got it out after years of being sort of a one-hit wonder, where he worked on Firefly and all these shows that lasted a season and got a lot of love but couldn't make the long run. Suddenly he started doing things like American Horror Story and show running this stuff with Ryan Murphy, and they all clicked and did really well. Finally he got his, you know, pet project up and running, and it's been a big hit right off the bat.
And my question is, when does he get sued by the creators of Emergency One? David Byrne has a new album out called American Utopia. It's pretty good, actually, and he's really excited about it. The one-time talking head blogged about his many collaborators on the album, posting images of all 25 men. The internet responded, really, David? All men, no women? That's not our idea of utopia. Byrne was chastened. He wrote, quote, I am happy that we live in a time that this conversation is happening. It's hard to realize that no matter how much effort you spend nudging the world in what you hope is the right direction, sometimes you are part of the problem. I never thought of myself as being one of those guys, but I guess to some extent I am.
He also said, this is not my beautiful house. This is not my beautiful wife.
Yes. Now, ironically, Google that, by the way, and put lyrics in the search box when you do that. Ironically, his most recent album before this was Love This Giant, a hugely acclaimed collaboration with St. Vincent, one of the most admired female artists of recent years, and their work together gave her the biggest audience to date of her career. Big Deal or Big Whoop?
It's a big whoop in the scheme of things. He was pointed out. He said, oh my God, you're right. I can't believe this. This is not who I am. This isn't what I'm like. This isn't how I've worked over the years. But it's interesting how people respond, how they deal, how they recognize their own blind spots, like I did with Jon Favreau. I'm like, oh, good. He did a good job. Oh, people are angry. You know, you get surprised and you want to think twice about it. So it's nice to know he's doing that. And it's nice to remember, hey, yeah, his last album was a pure collaboration with a woman, co-heads together, not just on a track, and it worked out great. So it's interesting to note. On a positive note, the RIAA named Tina Tchen, Michelle Obama's former chief of staff, to head their task force on inclusion. So right away, with a woman, a person of color, they're doing a good job of saying, hey, we know we've got a problem.
Yeah, you know, when I heard this kerfuffle, a word I will use many
times. It's the third
time
today.
Exactly. About David Byrne, I thought, really, you're going to pick him of all people? You might want to double check that, because his last album helped launch the career even more so than it already was of St. Vincent and Annie Clark. And now, mind you, she was already a musician. People knew about her, but she was kind of like an indie musician, and she became much more popular after the album Love This Giant.
Well, but David Byrne disagrees with you, little Mr. Retro White Man. You know, he said, okay, no, you make a good point.
All right. Well, you know. Major League Baseball loves the web. It has a best-in-show streaming app with a backroom so solid that Disney snapped it up so that they could launch their own streaming service. And those experiments with baseball games on social media and even YouTube, well, they're not experiments anymore. Facebook just signed a deal with MLB. 25 afternoon baseball games will stream live on MLB's Facebook page in North America. Heck, they'll stream worldwide, but they won't be exclusive. That's right. Certain afternoon baseball games will only be available for viewing on Facebook, and YouTube just re-upped its deal. MLB has a YouTube channel as part of its YouTube TV package, and the World Series will stream again online this October. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. It's a new world. Sports is so valuable and so in demand that we're seeing the prices sort of stabilize and maybe coming just slightly back to earth. But, you know, when the streaming apps and these websites are doing it, wow, that's a real game changer, I think. You know, suddenly NBC has competition, Fox has competition for something as big as football and baseball. On the other hand, it's 25 games. There are about 2,500 games this season. Afternoon games are the least in demand. So we're talking about 1% of the total available package going to Facebook. And let's face it, if you're streaming it in the afternoon on Facebook, that's probably when people are at work and might not mind having one window open on their computer screen.
Right. Well, and also, again, it's not exclusive, so it will still be on MLB TV. So, you know, it's an experiment, and you might wonder why Sheryl Sandberg or Jack Dorsey were kind of walked away from their board seats at Disney. This is why. You can't basically be vying for sports, sports coverage and be on the board of a company that owns ESPN. Now, speaking of sports, I'm so old, I remember watching people play pinball. Well, actually, I was waiting for my turn, and if I'm honest, I was alone most of the time. But enough about me. Watching other people do something really well, whether it's chess or ping pong, or yes, Donkey Kong, all games I'm not good at, it isn't that odd. It's even less odd when you become fans of players or teams and watch their strategy in action. That's why esports is on fire. Talking about words that we've used or phrases that we've used a couple times on this show. On fire, I think third time during Big Deal or Big Whoop we've used that. Sure, video games and online gaming has been huge business for decades. But now esports, competitive gaming, often with an audience and in an arena or online to catch a tournament, well, it's becoming huge too. The industry group Esports Entertainment Association says a lot of women play and watch. Their fans are diverse, and the business will hit $1 billion in 2018. So it's not just for nerdy white guys anymore. Big deal or big whoop?
Oh, it's a big deal, but let's not forget, nerdy white guys still rule. But as you keep pointing out in your entertainment and sexism commentary. But I think it's important because it's really hard to remember when you're not involved in it and you don't pay attention to it and you don't do it. You're like, oh no, video games are a really big business. Oh yeah, people are going to arenas to watch people play esports. It's crazy, but it's happening a lot. It's a $1 billion business now, and you just have to keep reminding yourself that this is happening and it's out there, because it's so, if you don't watch it or you don't see it or you don't play video games, you don't watch esports, you don't know what's happening. You don't know kids are online watching other people play video games. So we got to keep reminding ourselves, if you're not in that world, hey, this is happening. It's a big thing. There's a lot of money to be made.
Netflix is spending some $8 billion this year on content. That's a lot of money, but it's still kind of a shock when they add up all their TV shows and movies. Netflix plans to produce 80 original movies in this year alone, and their total number of TV shows will hit 700. More than 10% of them are non-English language shows, such as Germany's horror series Dark. The latest talent they're hoping to sign up, guess who that is, Michael?
Who?
The Obamas. Ah. That's right. As producers, though, maybe there's a sitcom in their future now that Cosby reruns are languishing. Maybe. I don't know. Big deal or big whoop.
Right. So they want the Obamas. That makes sense. They want to do positivity stuff to sort of raise up the spirits. They can get open doors, right? I didn't have no, of course, experience producing TV shows, but they can open doors and get people who want to do projects with them. They also just signed up. Norm MacDonald is doing a TV show for them. This is how you end up with 700 shows. That's 700 total, though, right away. I mean, it's not 700 new shows. For a minute, I thought, they're making 700 new shows this year? Really?
No, 700 total.
I'm like, are they counting each episode of each show as one show? What's going on here? I didn't understand that number. But finally, I realized they meant every show they've ever made that's in their library will hit 700, including however many new ones they have going on this year. I bet that number of 10% of the number of shows that are in international language, non-English, I bet that goes up.
Yes, and I think Obama was saying, I'll show you no drama, Obama. I don't know. That's a horrible Obama impersonation.
Okay. All right.
Because you know, no drama, and he's doing his show, so it's a drama.
So it's going to be a reality show or a comedy. Clearly not a drama. Okay.
Okay, but you didn't have to ruin the joke.
Sorry.
You stepped on the punchline. Anyway, Hollywood wants to find new ways to sell movie tickets, and they don't really mean through MoviePass. So Disney, Fox, which is kind of like saying the same thing now, Lionsgate, along with Fidelity Investments, they have pumped another $60 million into ticketing service Atom, A-T-O-M, and that's here in the United States. That comes on top of $50 million they invested 2 years ago. In other words, they really don't want Fandango to be the only game in town. Atom's big play? You can invite friends to see a movie using the app with everyone paying separately. Atom says it sells tickets for 20,000 screens in North America and boasts that it tripled users and ticket sales in 2017. And how many users does it have exactly? Well, Atom isn't saying. So, maybe it was 2 and now it's 6, but it tripled. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, I think. I mean, what is new here that they wanted to invest and they want to double their investment? What happened with Atom? What's the good news?
Well, the good news here is that Atom isn't going away when Fandango is basically scooped up its rival movie tickets. It scooped up Cine Papaya in Latin America. It scooped up Ingresso in Brazil. So, basically Fandango has just grown like a virus. It's kind of taken over web ticketing in certain territories to a point where there is no competition. And here in the U.S., these studios, they love to have two options. In most cases, that's why you have Deluxe and Technicolor, although now Deluxe and Technicolor for digital cinema are one, something the studios are not happy about.
Well, I like competition and new rivals and different companies popping up and up. Is there anything Fandango is doing that they shouldn't be doing or anything they're not doing that they should be doing that makes Hollywood unhappy?
Well, for a while they were, if you were Regal, let's say, you could only use Fandango. Fandango would say, you have to be exclusive with us. And now Fandango, realizing, we could be in for it if we continue that kind of monopolistic approach, allows for competition. So you can buy movie tickets on Fandango, you can buy movie tickets on Atom. I don't necessarily know whether it's anything that they're doing per se.
Are their fees too much?
Well, certainly their fees are, in line with what everybody else is charging.
No everybody else is what you're saying.
Well, tickets and movie tickets before them. Mm-hmm. But I think
I never bought tickets by Fandango ever. I would never do that. I'm not going to pay an extra $1.50 or whatever just to see a movie. It's already too expensive.
Yeah, I think I did it once or twice, and that was only because I didn't want to have to show up and have the movie sold out. And it was like a group of people, and mm-hmm. So I just said, all right, fine. I think it's more a matter of what they don't want, what the studios don't want to get into.
And that
situation where they're forced to work with a company and pay certain fees.
Okay.
Now, Univision is having a rough week. It scrapped a long-planned initial public offering to raise money, replaced its CFO, announced its CEO, Randy Falco, is retiring, and they did that even though his contract was just extended until 2020. And to top it off, the company fired another 20 of its 4,000 employees. Univision went private a decade ago at a price tag of $14 billion, and now those investors, they want to cash out. So the company, or parts of the company, are for sale. Most likely to be spun off? The division Fusion, which oversees English language offerings like the satirical website The Onion, Afrocentric online site The Root, and Gizmodo, aka Gawker. Fusion just happens to be the division, by the way, where most of those employees were reportedly laid off. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. Univision is a major player in the Hispanic Latinx market, and it's bad to see them in trouble. You know, Telemundo may be rubbing their hands with glee, but it's not good to have a big important player like this sort of tottering. So it's a little upsetting to see what's happening. Yeah, you know, but hey, we can't get Weinstein Company. Maybe we should buy this Fusion. You know, The Onion is a great property. The Root is a great property. Gizmodo, I don't know about.
Oh, Gizmodo, they're one of the top tech sites, websites going.
Well, why don't you want to snap it up? Don't you think somebody should be?
You know, just, media companies these days, they're so hard to run. But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Well, this week, the story that we have on tap, well, it could affect you really quite a lot, actually, if what the United States Department of Justice says is accurate. And what they're saying and claiming in their dispute, they have sued AT&T and Time Warner.
Well, I thought they want to stop the merger of AT&T and Time Warner, right?
Yes.
They said it'll be anti-competitive. And the next stage of the trial is beginning this week, and they filed a new trial brief, and apparently it just offers up new insight into what they're arguing. And I say what they're arguing, but as you point out, this is where all the action happens. It happens before the trial begins in a trial like this.
Right, because it's going to be a three-week trial. So they already know it's a three-week trial. Starts March 19th. I love this, the Star Wars defense, okay? This is what Time Warner and AT&T is claiming, because basically what the government is saying is that, quote, this merger will chart the course for the future of video content delivery in the United States, okay? And what the defense is saying, so AT&T and Time Warner, they're saying it's the Star Wars defense. No. That was an industry that it was like that a long time ago. It's not like that anymore. So the government is so behind the times.
Right. So they're saying their arguments don't apply anymore. It's a new world. There's so much competition now. They can't worry about our being anti-competitive because there's so many other players out there. And the government says, well, that's not true at all. There are real concerns of people in the real marketplace today. They say, you know, nowadays they have more tools and more ways to slow down individual websites or individual things. They can do things today they couldn't do before. So not only are they an anti-competitive problem, but they're even more anti-competitive if you look at all the new tools at their disposal.
Yeah, in ways that you might not necessarily even know about. Like, oh, yeah, your compression is just, you know, your video looks just a little bit worse than our video. Even down to that level.
So do you think the government made a better argument with this trial brief? Did you read this and go, wow, they're really making a strong argument? Do you think they're going to be able to block the AT&T Time Warner merger?
You know what? I don't know. It's a toss-up. I do think that they are making a very good case that, you know what, if you allow this, you're basically allowing vertical integration. The problem, and this is why it's hard to call, is that you basically allowed it with Comcast and NBC Universal. So,
you can,
you know,
break
what's
them
the
up.
Difference?
There's nothing stopping you from breaking them up.
Well, there's the question. A lot of people are saying, if the government is successful with AT&T and Time Warner, is Comcast going to be next? Will the government go after Comcast and try and break them up? What they would have to show in the Comcast instance is what Comcast and NBC Universal did that was anti-competitive, as opposed to showing the potential here with AT&T and Time Warner for potential anti-competitive behavior. They would have to show actual anti-competitive behavior with AT&T and Time Warner, with Comcast and NBC Universal.
And does this mean the Trump administration is more antitrust than the Obama administration, at least when it comes to media companies who they don't like?
I think that's you just hit the nail on the head. You know, Trump, when he was running, he said, I would never allow AT&T and Time Warner to merge. That's not going to happen. So he kind of has to, follow through on that. And he is.
Does
so
he? That's, he has to do everything he promised in his campaign. Someone should let him know.
Yeah.
Well, so I don't think, but I think they're choosing to do that. There's a lot of things he did in his campaign he didn't bother promising. He made a lot of promises he didn't keep, like closing the loophole on Wall Street, income that lets them pay a much lower tax rate. There's a lot of things he promised that he hasn't done. Most things he promised he didn't do. But this one he's sticking to. Is it strictly because he hates the media companies, or for some reason are they antitrust on this issue?
Well, let's first start with the fact that Time Warner owns CNN. Okay, so let's start there. I think it's the media companies, and he's not a fan of media companies, as you know.
And it's kind of ironic, isn't it? They're all for getting rid of net neutrality, but now they're worried about AT&T shutting out the competition.
Yeah, well, exactly. And the government is saying, look, if this merger goes through, a couple of harmful things for consumers are going to happen, okay? Mm-hmm. The first is that cable and satellite customers, their bills will rise. Okay, no doubt their bills will rise. And AT&T Warner's...
Despite all the new competition, like skinny bundles and things like that, and cord cutting and...
Right, that it doesn't matter because you still have to get your skinny bundle through a pipe that is delivered to you through Comcast or through AT&T, okay? So that's number one. Whereas AT&T and Time Warner, they're saying, what are you talking about? Through all these efficiencies that we're going to derive from, you know, basically merging, the costs will decline and we'll pass those cost savings along to our customers as we always do. Oh, yeah, no, I guess we don't. Now, the government also says the merger would harm competition, of course, by it would kind of constrain AT&T's rivals from using, say, HBO as a competitive advantage. So right now, Comcast can offer HBO, say, for $5 a month. If you sign up for Comcast HBO, it'll be $5 a month for the first 6 months. And AT&T and Time Warner could come along and say, no, we're not going to allow you to do that anymore. AT&T says, what are you talking about? That makes no sense. We need that distribution channel. That's a way for us to get new customers because they'll sign up for the $5 a month plan and then they'll stick around for 4 years. And that's what we need. So there's no way we would. Makes no sense.
So who's right? Is the government right that it shouldn't go through? Or is AT&T Time Warner right that, hey, everybody else is doing it, why not us?
I think that, you know, I think, you know, my feeling on this, I don't think that they should merge. I think that, you know, manufacturing and distribution, it is separated in the motion picture business for the most part, and it should be separated here. I think you get way too powerful when you can both create the content, control the content, and sell the content.
All right.
And so, you know, for instance, I guess here's a great example of this. You really could prevent, and this is what the government is saying, you could prevent rivals or virtual rivals, like these virtual rivals that are springing up, like the PlayStation View, these skinny bundle packages, the companies that are distributing them, like Dish Sling and PlayStation View. You could actually prevent them from growing in markets where you're providing internet service. And that's a problem.
I agree.
So certainly this is something we will be keeping an eye on over the next, well, I guess it's 4 weeks because the trial starts next week.
Right.
But it's...
And if they do it, then maybe the next thing they do is bust up Comcast Universal.
Well, again, you
know... Crazier things have happened.
Yeah, and that might be why Comcast is going after Sky now, as we discussed last week. Mm-hmm. But that wraps up Inside Baseball and moves us along to our obituary section. Russ Solomon... is the founder of, or was the founder of Tower Records, and he died at the age of 92.
Yeah, you know, Tower Records, it was all over the world at one point. It's so sad to have seen it come and gone, to live through the era of, you know, mega, you know, music stores, these meccas that you would go to, and they'd have everything. It just seemed like they owned, you could go to the jazz section and find like 40, 50 different Miles Davis albums. You go to the world section and find, you know, 10 Ladysmith Black Mambazo albums. It was just such nirvana for a music fan back in the day when you didn't have everything at the tip of your fingers on streaming. So, I mean, I still have a Tower Records bag. I still have a bag away in my storage locker. I just, you know, I kept one final one. You know, I used to use them all the time. They used to be really strong and good. I used them to ship books around and do this and that. And, you know, it just gets my heart beating faster. So sad to see him go. But you know, the world, the internet is so different now, and it makes so many things possible. It also makes nasty things possible, because there it is, the Variety story has a thing about, you know, Tower Records guy dying. There were one or two comments, and one person said, ah, what a shame, you know, I love Tower Records, I miss it so much. And the next one said, what a nasty person. Apparently they don't like Russ Solomon. I don't know, maybe he was a jerk. I have no idea, but I'm like, you felt the need to say that this 92-year-old man dies, and you're like, what a horrible person. That's all they said. It's like, oh, well, there's the internet for you.
Well, you know, we have also had our own commenters, although they wish to remain anonymous, and that is they emailed us to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And this person wishes to remain anonymous because, well, they aren't allowed to speak publicly due to their employment within the industry. But, well, they work for a studio or big television network. So if that narrows it down to, say, 500,000 people, maybe from Earth's 7 billion, so well, you can, you know, pick among them.
It's directed to you. So let me read it out loud. It says, "Oh, Sperling, educate yourself on the basic deal terms before giving commentary on the deals. No, the Disney acquisition of 21st Century Fox does not bring the Fox and ABC broadcast networks together, as the Fox broadcast network, along with Fox News and the National Cable Sports Network, are not included in the deal." Anonymous.
Yeah. Now, I have to say, when we were discussing it last week, if you listen to my how I'm discussing it, I realized that I said there's something in my head. There was just something not right about how I was discussing it. And I was so caught up in the Academy Awards of it all that I wasn't thinking straight. By the end of the show, I was beginning to go, oh, wait a second. And I just, you know, we were ending the show and I just said, just get through it. And then as I was editing, I went, oh, wait a second. Wait a second, Fox isn't included. And I tried to figure out a way to cut around it. And I said, no, it'll be like an Easter egg. Let's see if anybody picks up on it. And sure enough, a few people did, including Mr. Anonymous or Miss Anonymous.
Well, you know, yeah, sometimes you can't fix it in post. You would have if you could have.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not like you said, that'll be fun to leave a mistake in, but you couldn't fix it. But we appreciate you writing in, though. Frankly, it should have said, oh, Sperling and Michael, because I didn't catch it, though I should have. I should have known that, and I did know it, but I didn't point it out at the time. So my fault, too.
Well, you could write to us, just like the anonymous commenter did, at dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter. At Showbiz Sandbox is our handle, or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. All of that information can be found on showbizsandbox.com, our website. That's where you'll find ways to subscribe to us so you never miss an episode. We can be found on iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can subscribe to us and rate and review the show. It does help us out when you do. In fact, it helps other listeners out when you rate and review the show so that they can find our show as well. That information, along with links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. And Michael Gilts has a website every week. It's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's ivegotnothing.com.
He's got no new website. Although, if you want to find all of Michael's work aggregated, all of his coverage of the entertainment industry, why not head on over to michaelgilts.com, or don't forget to check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.